Well, welcome back to Luke. Just a reminder that this writer tends to pay more attention than other Gospels to the lives and experiences of women. Some think that he might have spoken with Jesus' mother Mary, since he's the only Gospel writer that includes details from her experience of some of the events. And you'll remember also that Luke is especially concerned with political realities and with economic justice and equitable reciprocal sharing of resources. Along these lines, themes of economic reversal that we saw in Mary's song, for example, are on full display in the Sermon on the Plain, which came right before. Those are the words that Jesus finished delivering right before our story today. Unlike Matthew's Sermon on the Mount, Luke's version includes woes after the blesseds and says, you know, blessed are the poor rather than poor in spirit. And woe to you who are rich, for you have already received your comfort. This will connect with our stories today in a sort of background kind of way. About 12 and a half years ago, as some of you know, I worked for Eastern District and, well, what were then Eastern District and Franconia conferences that are now both Mosaic together. We called the role Minister of Peace and Justice. Part of my work in that role, which unfolded in a very organic and kind of unexpected way, was connecting with combat veterans and participating in healing circles for those who were ready for that experience. Now, I was not leading these circles. I was a participant and just actively listening. And I learned so much as I heard people's stories and their pain and began to understand in a more personal and embodied way how war affects the soldiers who are carrying it out. And I had a lot of opportunities to see these really neighbors, to see their human faces and their lives wounded at a soul level from participating in government-sponsored violence and killing. For me, as somebody committed to nonviolence and peacemaking, peace building, part of what was wonderful about this experience was learning that most people who've been in combat actually hate war and are against it. The veterans that I interacted with understood that they carried what's called moral injury. This is a term that, I don't know, appeared in 2008 or 9 or something, as far as I know. But they had something that was a deep moral injury from their experiences. You might be familiar with this term. Moral injury occurs when a person perpetrates, fails to prevent, or witnesses acts that are contrary to or violate deeply held beliefs. For example, the basic belief that killing is wrong, or that people should honor each other's dignity and not harm each other. I got to see up close, and I really respected the hard emotional and spiritual work these vets were doing to move toward their own healing, which of course was also a gift to their loved ones, like spouses, children, and their friends. I really didn't expect to find myself relating with veterans like this, but it was often profound. And it seemed really fitting to me for at least some Mennonites to engage in friendship and support with people who clearly knew that they had damaged their own humanity in participating in war. What a way to embody our desire for peace, to come alongside and support folks who were healing from the wrong they had done or been part of or seen, and who had recognized the war machine for what it is and were actively divesting from toxic military culture. Some of these people became powerful advocates for peace. I thought of this experience as I was wondering, what exactly was it like between, what was the relationship like between this Roman centurion and the local Jewish people in this story? There seems to be a lot of good feeling between them. the Jewish elders who come to Jesus to tell him that this Roman military commander of 100 troops loves our people and had sponsored the building of their synagogue and therefore deserves or is worthy to have Jesus come and heal the centurion's servant, or realistically, an enslaved person in the centurion's household. Biblical scholars wonder what exactly the centurion was doing in this area, because in Capernaum, in that whole region of Galilee, there were no Roman troops stationed at that time. He could be a border, part of a border patrol, or maybe he's retired and he just really liked the area, so he stayed and settled. Either way, the Roman military officer loves the Jewish people and gave the money that was needed to build the synagogue. Now, going beyond what the text offers us, I wonder, I think it's reasonable to imagine, in a time that was much more violent than ours, that this man also would have experienced moral injury. At least he would have been part of some very coercive behavior that did not honor the dignity of the people he was commissioned to keep under Roman control. Certainly, we're not privy to his inner thoughts and feelings, but I wonder how he came to love the Jewish people and want to be generous with them. I do wonder if he knew that he needed to heal from the violence he'd been part of, and if this was part of that healing. We don't know. But whatever his motivations, the centurion acted as a kind of patron. When in Roman culture, a person with financial means provides for people who need it and expects some kind of loyalty in return. Maybe the Jewish elders see this as an opportunity to reciprocate. And before, all they could do was offer their gratitude and live peaceably with him. We read that the commander cares about this particular enslaved person who is dangerously ill. The Greek is not completely clear about this, but the nature of his concern. We could read it as he valued the enslaved one, or that he was dear to him, like a close companion. Now, certainly we recognize that there's a severe power imbalance between the two people, and it's impossible to know for sure what their connection was. And we don't get any glimpse of the enslaved person's perspective in the story. But we do see that the centurion is advocating for their healing. And the storyteller clearly wants us to have a favorable impression of the centurion. So let's assume that his care for this person is genuine and goes beyond a utilitarian kind of valuing. Another thing that we see really clearly, which is pretty surprising, is this commander is humble. He knows his own power. When I tell this person to go, they go. When I tell the slave to do something, they do it. And then he also knows the limits of his power. He knows he can't heal this person. And he respects Jesus and Jesus' power. This is a very unusual centurion. It would have been much more common for tension and mutual distrust and even hatred to be what is flowing between Jewish occupied communities and Roman military officers. And centurions routinely abused their power and dealt out grueling punishments to the infantry under their command, so we can imagine how unconcerned they would be about brutal violence toward the inhabitants of Judea, whose religion they did not understand, who you know, they didn't share any culture with them. So it's no wonder Jesus is amazed by this guy. Jesus makes a huge statement about this commander's faith. I have not found faith like this, even in Israel. Now, Jesus clearly has found faith among his own people, as evidenced by his followers who left everything to come and travel with him and learn from him. But Jesus is really taken aback by this level of trust that the man is putting in him. And maybe is Jesus also amazed at his humility? The elders of Jesus' own people have said that he is worthy, but the centurion himself says, I am not worthy to have you come under my roof. Don't even come to my house. I didn't even want to come to you personally. It is indeed amazing to see someone with so much power in the world, in what we might call the geopolitical realm, actually recognizing and publicly admitting that he does not have power in the spiritual realm, and honoring the power that Jesus does have. Jesus meets this man where he is, with the understanding he has of the world and its power structures. And this interaction, even though Jesus doesn't even meet the centurion, is the main event of the story. The actual healing kind of takes a back seat and happens off stage. Are there parallels here for us in some ways? When we are in leadership positions, how might we also lean on Jesus' power while being honest about our own, the power that we do have? I wonder how we might do that. And beyond that, this story gives me hope for possibilities of relationships between ordinary people of faith and people with power and authority who are able to recognize the limits of that authority. Have you, by chance, come across the rare centurion of our time in our context? I'm sure there are still people in positions of power who can admit the limits of that power and choose not to abuse it. People with whom we might have a surprising relationship with. As we move in the power we share with Jesus as we trust God, and because we belong to God. I realize that in these times, humble leaders will not be the first to come to mind. But the surprise of this story makes me wonder, where are the places among some rare people where we can stand in the divine power of vulnerable love and passion for a just peace? And relate across borders that we thought were closed to us? How might we relate with people who have very different lives and values, experiencing mutual positive regard across what would have been normally hard and fast boundaries? Where might we experience a softer coexisting, like the Jewish elders experienced with the centurion? These are really live questions for me. And I hope you'll tell me if you have ideas or if you bump into this hopeful possibility in your own life. The relationship between the centurion and the Jewish community was way more delightfully surprising than my relating with veterans. Surely more unexpected connections are to come, connections that lead toward healing. The second healing story in Luke 7 seems even more spontaneous. Like the first, the healed person does not, and actually in this one cannot, ask for it. Jesus and his disciples and the crowd traveling with him come upon a funeral procession. A widow, surrounded by her community, is about to bury her only son. You'll remember that widows, along with orphans and foreigners or immigrants, are people for whom God is especially concerned because they're especially vulnerable. God's people are to show their gratitude for God's deliverance and love to them by treating these people with respect and care, being sure they have what they need. The death of an only son was an economic catastrophe for a widow. She would have no legal inheritance, and without her son's economic support in that culture, she would have to depend on charity. Now, it seems that the widow's neighbors, the townspeople, are doing as they should in supporting her in her loss, and maybe they would have continued to show up and care for her, but from the text, we just don't know that. Jesus feels this woman's extreme vulnerability deep in his being. The Greek word for compassion here is splaknizomai. Splaknizomai. I wanted to ask Grace if she could say that with me. This word comes from the word for guts, like intestines, which for that culture was the place where one feels things most deeply. A corresponding Hebrew word is rachem or rachamim, which means mercy or compassion. And that same Hebrew word also refers to womb, the womb. So Jesus is feeling this in a deep and tender part of himself. Jesus sees her and is moved in his depths with compassion. Even without the layer of possible impending financial ruin, this is a loss of a child, which is terrible beyond words. No matter what the circumstance. Certainly, Jesus is also responding to the profound grief of this mother. The inconsolable sadness he may have seen on other parents' faces in the wake of such an incredible loss. Jesus is moved by her weeping. He steps toward her, perhaps his own eyes also filling with tears. Jesus touches the stretcher on which the body was lying, making himself unclean according to Jewish purity laws, which meant he couldn't enter the temple to worship or pray with his gathered community. Jesus does not seem concerned with this at that moment. He speaks to the body, breath returns, and the son sits up, and Jesus returns him to his mother. It's really rare in the gospel stories that Jesus would use the divine power flowing through him to raise someone from the dead. Why this in this particular circumstance? He doesn't know these people. Maybe this is a taste of the new heavens and the new earth when death and mourning will be no more and God will wipe all the tears from our eyes, as we see in John's vision of Revelation. We don't know Jesus' exact motivation in raising this particular person back to life, but it seems like a direct result of his compassion, his deep compassion, how moved he was by this woman's sorrow in that moment. Jesus knows he can't heal everyone. He's one person. But almost impulsively, he chooses to do this for this woman. We'll come back to that impulsive compassion in a moment. It just so happens that these two healing stories are in parallel with two healing stories from the Old Testament or Hebrew Bible, healings that were performed by Israel's two great first great prophets, Elijah and Elisha. You remember the story of Elijah and the widow of Zarephath, who is a foreigner, and he goes to her in the midst of a famine. And by God's power, the oil and her last bit of flour do not run out, so she's able to feed herself and Elijah and her son for many days. And Elijah stays with them. She's hosting him. And while he's with them, you might remember that this widow's son becomes ill and dies. And Elijah raises the son back to life. This phrase, "gave him to his mother," that we see in Luke, is an exact quote from 1 Kings 17:23 in the Elijah story. And the healing of the enslaved person in the centurion's household has a lot of parallels with the healing of Naaman or Naaman in 2 Kings 5. And you might also remember Naaman is a general in an enemy army. Elisha never speaks directly or sees Naaman. The healing happens at a distance, and there are a few different intermediaries who help Naaman to be healed, to make the connection with the prophet. And these particular Elijah and Elisha stories also happen to be the two stories Jesus references in his Nazareth sermon in Luke 4. Yet we keep going back to that inaugural sermon where Jesus claims his mission, reading from the scroll of the prophet Isaiah, to preach good news to those who are poor, to proclaim release to the prisoners, recovery of sight to the blind, to liberate the oppressed, and to proclaim the year of God's favor, the Jubilee, an economic reset in which everyone gets a clean slate. So now, as all this time has passed, Jesus is embodying and enacting these stories that he said he would, this release that and this healing that he said he was going to be bringing, both among foreigners and occupying soldiers and with vulnerable ones among his own people. I noticed the significance of community and friendship in both of these stories. We see people advocating on behalf of someone who could benefit from an encounter with Jesus. Are there ways we could maybe be doing something like that? We see people literally walking alongside their neighbor at a devastating time. We see humility and trust in divine power arising from a most unexpected person. And we see an alliance between people who in other situations would have feared and hated each other. In these deeply sad times, in this moment, when we need these kinds of surprising connections, where divine abundance flows instead of isolation or violation, when you or I am deeply moved with compassion, may we also act on it, right in the moment if we can. Let's keep awake to those gut-level moments of compassion within us and move with them. And let's watch for possibilities to relate with people who could become unexpected allies. Let's keep looking for the active presence and transforming power of God in all places, among all people. And may we have reason to give thanks for these good surprises.